Welcome to the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester's podcast, Mind Your Mentality, where your minds matter. I'm Jessica LaChance, and I will be your host for this episode. Joining us from our rapid response team is Matt Davis, and today we will discuss crisis intervention and how something as simple as a phone call can be life-saving. And I've been with the Mental Health Center of Greater Manchester for about 28 years. I started as a new grad, and throughout the years, I've been in different programs here. Since about 2016, I've been the director of our mobile crisis response team, otherwise known as our rapid response team. A lot of the experiences I had along the way really helped kind of taking on this challenge of developing this team for our agency. I'm going to turn it over to Matt for a minute. He can talk a little bit about his experience with the Mental Health Center. Matt?
Yeah, my name is Matt. I've been with the Mental Health Center for about 8 years. I started in the summer of 2018, I believe. I came to the Mental Health Center. This is my second career, actually. You know, this is a change in my life. And I came to the Mental Health Center as a peer support. Now, once I came to the Mental Health Center as a peer support, it just felt like a good connection. You know, I felt like I was wanted and needed here. And so I continued my education. I earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. I was a clinician on the homeless outreach team for a little while, and now I'm the coordinator for the rapid response team.
That's great. Thanks, Matt, for sharing that. So we're going to talk a little bit about sort of how the mobile crisis team came to be. And prior to 2016, we really depended on the emergency services model of care, which basically meant if somebody was in crisis, probably the thing to do was to go to the emergency department and have an assessment done there, which may or may not lead to a hospitalization. But we really didn't have a formalized way of meeting people where they were at. I remember working in our community support services department, and there'd be times when we might have somebody outside of our building who was maybe not connected to mental health services, but was identified as somebody potentially being in crisis. And I would grab a coworker and we would go outside and find out what was going on and try to help connect the person. But really, in terms of what to do from there, a lot of it really depended on our emergency department. And that's how a lot of community mental health centers have operated. And that's really been sort of the culture in mental health, is that in crisis, you go to the emergency department. But we learned that the state was really looking at mobile crisis response teams as an alternative to that. And we were fortunate to be the second team in the state to develop a mobile crisis team. 2015, 2016 is when we started our planning. And we really had to look at the model and figure out, okay, what does our mobile crisis team look like? Matt, I'm going to have you help me kind of talk a little bit about the makeup of our team. So,
you know, we have a pretty broad makeup. It's interdisciplinary, which is a very difficult word to say. Interdisciplinary. That means that, you know, we have clinicians, so people with master's degrees in the field of mental health counseling or social work. And then we have peer supports, which are people with lived experience. And then we have bachelor staff. And those are people with bachelor's degrees who are typically case managers within the agency. A lot of those people are full-time staff. We also do have a lot of per diem staff that comes and does shifts with us.
Yeah, we also have, I think, the ability to consult with a psychiatrist. Can you talk a little bit about that, Matt?
Sure, yeah. We do have a psychiatrist on call. We have our medical director is actually one of the psychiatrists on call, too. When we go out into the field as a clinician, sometimes, you know, we have to do consultations. You know, we don't know what's going on. We do have to consult about dispositions and outcomes. So when that's the case, we give the on-call doctor a call. It's 24/7. They can support us. They can kind of coach us and then kind of determine what the next best steps may be, clinically speaking.
Thinking about the people on our team, I remember when we first started Mobile Crisis, it really was an endeavor to figure out how we were going to staff 24/7 firehouse model of being available as soon as a crisis comes up in the community. So we really had to spend a lot of time with recruitment and getting people to our team. We were very fortunate to connect with some folks who had experience doing Mobile Crisis in other areas of the country. We're very grateful for that. And of course, we had to do a lot of training ourselves and make sure that we were utilizing the core principles of mobile crisis when we were going out. So we had a lot of staff that also joined us from other teams within our agency and received some training to be able to provide mobile crisis. Our world changed a little bit when the state made the decision that they wanted to expand mobile crisis to all 10 community mental health centers in the state. Part of that was really looking at how well the mobile teams were doing in Concord, Manchester, and Nashua, and realizing that we really needed to get this service out to all corners of New Hampshire. But I want to talk for just a moment about 988. When we went statewide in January 2022, 988 was not live yet. It did not exist. And the FCC basically said all telecom systems need to implement 988 by July of 2022. So about 6 months into statewide access point, 988 was rolled out nationwide. But really, basically, what we're trying to say is there is no wrong door. So if somebody calls 988 in crisis and they do need a mobile crisis team, 988 will transfer that person to the New Hampshire access point. So it is working, and that number is out there and helping people. All right, so enough of all the history. Let's talk about what actually happens on a mobile response. Somebody calls the access point and is looking for a mobile crisis team. The access point will triage that call. They'll ask some pertinent questions around what is happening, what are they looking for, and asking some safety questions so that when they send out a response, the team is aware of, are there pets in the home? Are there other people in the home? Things that might determine a level of safety that's needed for the team that is responding. And so there's a lot that clinician is really working with. They're working with the individual. They may be working with their supports in the community. We have a peer who comes with us on that call. And Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about what a peer does?
You know, peer support is a person with lived experience, either with recovery from mental health issues or recovery from substance use issues, or both. Peer will use that lived experience during that crisis call to kind of connect with the individual that is in crisis. Because we've found that, you know, connection fosters the ability to kind of plan and recognize what's going on a little bit better. Then we can utilize our lived experience and that connection to, you know, assist the clinician in assessing and safety planning if possible.
Yeah, and I know sometimes we have folks who we see. In fact, I think it's almost half the time, really. I think it's around 40% or so that we see folks who aren't connected at all to their local mental health center or not receiving any mental health supports. How does a peer help?
Yeah, so a peer can absolutely help with that, you know, and part of that connection and that lived experience is sharing that, how we got through that, how we as the peer kind of made that connection, found what was right for us and found what worked. There's a lot of different peer support agencies in the city, so we can refer to those peer support agencies. We can also, you know, meet people kind of regularly or just check in on our phone calls with them on a regular basis, you know, because we're here to kind of support people, not kind of actually support people.
I know that one of the things that we talk about a lot on our team is that a lot of folks that we work with have had some degree of trauma. A lot of the supports that we're doing during a crisis are trauma-informed. And a couple of examples of that are empowerment and choice. So sometimes even just the language shifting from what is wrong with you to what happened to you really helps to give that person control over their care. The trustworthiness and transparency, maintaining that open, honest communication to build trust. And Matt, you spoke a little bit about how the peer role is really using that lived experience to establish that trustworthiness and transparency. That doesn't always happen in crisis care, right? And then, of course, safety first. You know, we want to make sure that where we're meeting with the person, how we're conducting the crisis assessment, that it helps to support both physical and psychological safety to prevent further distress. I know we've had times when we've worked with people in the home that there's a lot of conflict happening in the home. And so really trying to work with that person on how can we give them a safer space to talk about what's happening with them and give them that ability to really have that open, honest communication. And then avoiding re-traumatization, using non-threatening, compassionate, cultural sensitive approaches, working with people. A lot of folks I've worked with have talked about even traumatization they've had in the emergency departments or working with law enforcement. And so having that ability to really be aware of that and know that there are things that we can do to help mitigate that feeling of re-traumatization. Anything else that you want to add to that?
Yeah, thank you, Jess. And as a peer, thinking about trauma-informed care, you know, I think that we as peers kind of have that in the forefront, you know, and that's the assumption that we don't know what we're going out to see on a crisis call, so that we may be walking into a home where people have been traumatized by one thing or another. So having that understanding that when we go to meet a person that they may have experienced trauma. So that's knowing that we can kind of work forward with that and have an understanding of where they're coming from.
And I think too, just having that ability to give that space to listen. A lot of what we do is really just giving that person that space creating that sort of quiet, calm environment. We do this during the crisis evaluation. A lot of the times what we're doing is really focusing on, okay, what happens next? What is the safety planning component of it? I don't know if Matt, you want to talk a little bit about like what a safety plan might look like?
Sure, yeah. So safety plans, I love safety plans because it's a thing. It's a tangible piece of paper that we work through with a patient and we can give that to them. So a lot of mental health practices, you know, that's the conversation and the talking, you don't get anything tangible, but a safety plan is tangible. So I like that aspect of it as well. So a safety plan, I like to talk to our clients and I tell them it's kind of like a roadmap of emotions and feelings and what to do about them if they become too much to handle. You know, we work through and identify, help a person identify troubling emotions, troubling thoughts and behaviors, you know, and then try to figure out ways that they can internally cope with that stuff. Things that have worked in the past are ideal. If nothing's worked in the past or if things haven't worked in the past, we can try other stuff. We have 101 different coping skills to try. So once we do that, you know, we want to find the best support for a person in crisis is the natural supports, if that's available, right? So we want to try to find, you know, a best friend or a mom or a pop or something like that. And if that's not available or inclusion of that, we also want to provide the professional referrals. So that 988, 201, and 911, those referrals to those important community partners. Then obviously we come up with a plan for going forward from the crisis to the next day. And then my favorite question always is, what's the most important thing to you and worth living for? It always rings a bell, I think, you know, and once we get to that point, I think the person in crisis believes that there's hope, you know? So if we can get there, that there's hope.
I love that. And I think hope can't be understated in terms of what we provide and being able to help folks get through that. This moment, which could be, you know, one of the worst moments that they've had in their lifetime. When we work with people in crisis, you just never know. It could be really the worst day of their lives. And being able to say, you know what, there is tomorrow and here's what we can do to help is really powerful. And that kind of leads into crisis stabilization and what happens once we leave that call. But we do have the ability to help folks with crisis stabilization. Hey, Matt, you can chat a little bit about that and what happens once we leave the house, once we leave that crisis situation, what happens?
You know, one of the best things about the ability that we're offered here is that we can follow a person up to 30 days after the initial crisis if they're not connected to a service. So that's where crisis stabilization and caring contact phone calls come into play. So immediately after the crisis call, after we safety plan, we'll set up for caring contacts, just telephone calls for the next few days, right? And just checking with the person at their convenience to see how they're doing. We'll also attempt to schedule some crisis stabilization appointments, which is a counseling appointment with a bachelor staff. Typically, we have one particular staff who's a regular crisis stabilization counselor. So those are typically half-hour sessions. You know, it is what it sounds like. It's crisis stabilization. And so we're kind of ensuring that the crisis that did happen is not coming back. You know, we're kind of talking about what got them to that point. Maybe we're talking about what they can do going forward. You know, our goal is to connect to services. So that's what we're going to try to do. One of the other options, too, that we do have available is a connection to our med provider along with that crisis stabilization. So that's an APRN that we have on staff here. And she can also see you for those 30 days while you're doing that crisis stabilization.
Yeah, that's great. Going back to the safety planning, I think when you were talking about it, I was thinking of it really as a fluid document, and that crisis stabilization really allows some review of that. And is what was put on the day of the crisis, is that still working? Mm-hmm. Are there phone numbers that maybe need to be added? Or is there a particular skill that the person is using for coping that just isn't working so well? And so maybe thinking about ways to cope when someone feels a crisis coming on. So it really is a work in progress, and it's really helping that person to kind of reflect on, okay, how can I kind of shore up all of my coping skills and some of the things that might help me in the future? So I know we have a couple of examples of some of the things that we've done. I don't know if Matt, you want to give us an example of a crisis call that we've done in our
youth. Sure, yeah. Actually, I was thinking about it, you know, and I asked some of the staff, and they gave me a couple of good ones. So she had met with a person who we had seen on crisis calls a handful of times over the course of the last few weeks, right? So it was a recurring crisis, and it was a thing that kind of repeated the person in the crisis stabilization, the peer support that was in the crisis stabilization appointment with the client, was able to allow the client a safe place to recognize that they could get help if they asked for it, right? She said that it clicked for her there for the client, and then she was connected, and she is still connected to this day. And I think it's a couple of years later now. So we haven't heard from her crisis-wise again, and that sounds like she's still connected to the agency, which is amazing. And that's the whole point, right?
Sometimes folks get kind of trapped in that cycle of crisis and may get some immediate relief from the crisis, but haven't had that opportunity to really work on some of the things that can be preventative and really help to build sort of that supply of coping skills and things that may help them in the future. And thanks for sharing.
Yeah. I got another one for an outreach. So I went with one of our regular second shift clinicians with the police. They were very supportive, amazingly so. So the call was out to one of the bridges in the city, and it was a 15-year-old gentleman. And he was depressed. And I can't remember the specifics of why he was sad and why he was depressed, but he was contemplating jumping off of the bridge. So a community member called, the police showed up, they called us out, we went out, and Josh started doing an assessment. And the young man was engaged with Josh, but he could tell he was holding something back. The clinician kind of stepped away and he called the doc just to consult. And I talked to the client, and I was able to just allow him a safe place and allowing for an emotional connection, I think it was, you know. And then he was able to like identify that, you know, sure, things were terrible for a little while, but things can get better, right? There is some sort of hope. Again, that hope is what we're all looking for, you know. So once that happened, you know, I brought the clinician back and we were able to kind of follow through with the assessment, and we were able to come up with a safety plan. And the officer actually offered to drive this kid home. So he did that.
Such great stuff. And I love that you talk about the police. And I think this is a good segue to really kind of reflect a little bit on our collaboration and our partnership with our police officers. And going back to the very beginning of our mobile crisis team, this was something that our CEO had a vision of bringing in our law enforcement partners, knowing that they are the folks a lot of the time that people in crisis are interacting with. We were fortunate prior to mobile crisis to begin working on crisis intervention training with the Manchester Police Department. Crisis intervention training, or CIT training, is a specialized program that provides 40 hours of training for law enforcement. And that has now been expanded to other first responders as well. It was primarily designed with law enforcement in mind to really help give them the skills to have a conversation, to work with people who are having a behavioral health crisis, to give them some basic knowledge and education around some of the different presentations, people who are suffering with mental health conditions, what that looks like, and give them another way to really connect and interact. And that to this day has been one of the community partnerships that has really helped our team to shine, is being able to work with our police department, Manchester, and our other local police departments to really work together on these cases. I want to shift for a minute too and talk a little about other community partners and how we've connected with them. Matt, I don't know if you have some thoughts about some of the community partnerships when we talk about it, what comes to mind?
The number one community partner, I think, is the Manchester Police Department. Our close number two, if not another number one, would be our homeless services in the city. So the shelters, there's two shelters in the city. And I think that we serve them and they serve us a lot, you know, so it's a back and forth partnership. So yeah, I think that that's the biggest, you know, our community partner there with them and the schools in the city, of course.
Yeah. And then having a homeless outreach team as part of the mental health center has also really helped to foster that relationship as well. And we have many stories of folks who we've worked with together and helped connect them to the different partners across the city. I also think about a lot of the schools that we work with that we have pretty much daily. We have during the school year, we're requested to help out if they have a kiddo or student who's in need of some in the moment supports. We've been able to respond in real time. It also provides follow-up care as well. But yeah, I think we have a lot of different community partners over the years. We've really shifted their culture as well. And it's taken a lot of years to really build that trust between community partners to know that there is another avenue that any of our first responders can take if they do have somebody in crisis, and that is to reach out to a mobile crisis team to help out. So that was a lot to talk about. And I think to kind of wrap up a little bit, I want to just kind of reflect a little bit on the future of our team and the future of mobile crisis. Sort of what are some of the things we'd like to see I know for me, I'm really focused on sort of the statewide system and being able to really expand that out and improve on the system. Our goal really is to have somebody, no matter where they are in the state of New Hampshire, to have a very consistent level of high quality services when they're in crisis, and to really have that look the same no matter where you are in the state. And throughout the 10 community mental health centers, I think we're all in a different space in terms of when we started our mobile team, our staffing, our recruitment efforts, and things like that. But we are moving towards a system that I think is now going to be focused on quality. Now that these teams are established, they're up and running, we're all talking with each other. We're working across regions with different law enforcement. We're learning by example. We're sharing the things that are going really well and the things that need improvement. And so for me, the future really looks like enhancing that and really looking back and saying, wow, New Hampshire really stands out. Lofty goals. Matt, any thoughts from you?
I have hope for the future. You know, I was hesitant when the state got involved with mobile crisis, just because I'm scared of change like most people are. But, you know, it's turned out to be something wonderful, I think, because now we're able to serve more people. We're able to offer the same services to the entire state, not just our city. So I think that's great. So I have a lot of hope for the continuation of that and the expansion of our services. I think that, like you were saying, we're now in a place where we have the teams and they're working, and now it's time to improve. And I think that that's my role in this improvement, is kind of the clinical aspect as the coordinator. So, and that's what I'm hoping to do, is try to help our staff to kind of grow in a clinical space and a peer support space.
What would you say to someone who's thinking about joining our mobile crisis team?
Come on, let's go. Let's go for a ride. I think that it takes a certain type of person to do this work, for sure. It is one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done with my life. And that's not to say that every day is rainbows and sunshines, because that is definitely not the case. But when those small wins do happen, they are exponentially huge.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think this is a very challenging yet extremely rewarding. You know, us mobile crisis folks, we're not office people. We like to run towards the danger, you know, have sort of that pseudo first responder role, I think. But to be able to really reach somebody in their darkest moments, I think that just speaks for itself in terms of how powerful our work can be in helping save lives. I think this is a great place to end. So thank you for listening.